Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
People of Asian descent have been part of the fabric of American society since the beginning. But regardless of their contributions to American history, regardless of how long Asian Americans have had roots in the United States, some other Americans think of them as perpetually foreign, and others feel justified in scapegoating them for everything from sexual temptation to COVID-19. We really have to be better than this. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Vishakha N. Desai is Senior Advisor for Global Affairs to the President of Columbia University, Chair of the University's Committee on Global Thought, and author of the forthcoming book World as Family, A Journey of Multi-Rooted Beginnings. She's been a U.S. citizen for decades, but she still finds herself confronted by people who assume her Indian identity trumps her American one. And incidents like that cause her to feel violence against other Asian Americans in a visceral, personal way. For all the differences among Americans with origins in four dozen Asian countries, the prejudice they're subjected to seems universal to the Asian American experience. She joins us now to talk about this. Vishakha, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Reported violence against Asian Americans has jumped 150% since the start of the pandemic. This is a truly alarming statistic, but you note it is sadly not inconsistent with the way this country has treated people of Asian descent, at least since the 19th century.
That, I think, is actually something we really have to remember, is that this time it's much more visible, but it's part of a long, long history of treating Asian Americans or Americans of Asian descent as somehow not American enough. And it goes right back. One thing we know is the incarceration of Japanese Americans, or what we used to call internment camps. It didn't happen to other people, but it happened to Japanese. Why? Because there is this feeling that when you see an Asian face, that somehow they're more Asian than they're American. As it happened also with 9/11, that people of South Asian descent, it didn't matter where they came from, because they looked like the terrorists, as it were, that whether they were Sikhs or Indians or Pakistanis or something else, the crime against them went way, way up, including murders of people. So there is something about our experience in America that unites us, actually. As you pointed out, Chris, we've come from all kinds of places, all over the map. Half the human race, after all, lives in Asia. So there are hundreds of countries, thousands of languages, multiple cultures. It's not our Asian cultures that unite us. It is our American experience that actually brings us together. And unfortunately, what this current spate of violence suggests is also our American experience as being seen as the other, as the foreigner, not American enough, that creates these problems.
One thing that gutted you, hearing the news of the murders in Atlanta in which 6 of 8 victims were of Asian descent, was realizing you weren't surprised.
That was the thing, because what surprised me was it's the first time that people were sort of paying attention to this. Then it comes out that this has been happening every time there's a problem with some other Asian country. So in this case, whether it's the so-called China virus or Wuhan virus, as the former president tried to actually identify coronavirus as, and or sexualizing of the exoticism of Asian women. All of this makes them more other than anybody else. And yet, in fact, in Atlanta, there was a big discussion whether this was a hate crime or not. So then you say, wait a minute. How long does it have to be before you recognize that?
One thing people have noted is that, you know, the investigators say perhaps it's not a hate crime. There are questions to be raised about where the bar gets to be set. In this case, it seems like we're allowing the suspect to decide it's not a hate crime. He said that he didn't have anything against them because of their race, and therefore it can't be a hate crime.
That's exactly it. And therefore, you're saying who's deciding what's a hate crime? The perpetrator or the one who is victimized? And then you have to ask yourself that question again and again. And that is that when he says it's not because they were Asian, and yet when six women were actually murdered, all of them of Asian descent, there are other people who work in these areas, but he goes to the area where they're predominantly Asian. So it has something to do with exoticism of the racial configuration that also makes them the other. And that has to be defined in a broader way than a hate crime that you might typically define as only one kind of prejudice, right? Which is only negative.
Sometimes people raise this question, well, why should a hate crime be worse than any other kind of crime if a murder is a murder and the result is the same? Will you talk about how you would answer that?
You know, one of the things I keep thinking about, and it's something that I also write about in my book, In World as Family, and that is that when we think about naming of something, it says something. So if you say it's just a murder, and you don't recognize that the what is the kind of underlying current that causes that murder, you will never go to the cause of that murder. These murders are not the same as any other murder. And that is one of the reasons why you have to name something. When you name it, then you recognize what you do about that. So for Asian Americans, for example, to be called model minority, which is what often they are called, it does not take into account all of the other issues that go with them because they are the model, right? And therefore, they shouldn't have any problems. And yet, the reality is that actually close to 12 to 15% of people of Asian descent in this country are in below the poverty line. Most people don't know that because we only focus on the high academic achievements of some of the groups of Asian Americans.
How might we reform the standards that determine what gets counted as a hate crime in order to protect more people?
I think that we do have to actually look at not just the intent, but also the action itself. So you have to ask, for example, if certain groups of people are killed en masse, why is that happening? What is going on here? So that you look at the idea of othering people that also can be part of the prejudice and therefore turning into hate. And this is not with the legal, I'm not a lawyer, so I couldn't tell you exactly how you would do it, but I think you do have to have an expansive notion of what is the intent and what is underneath and behind that intent. And then decide. And at the same time, I mean, I wouldn't be just saying that it's hate crime or not, but I think that the prejudicial elements of such crimes have to be taken into account.
How are various Asian American communities coming together to comfort and to protect one another in the wake of this very challenging year?
You know, I have to say that as an Asian American, as an Indian American, as an American of Indian descent, I would acknowledge that oftentimes within the Asian American communities, we have not always acknowledged that all of us are actually united because of our American experience. We have very different cultural backgrounds. We don't have a lot that we necessarily share in terms of linguistic backgrounds or other things. But what is happening now is that actually not just Asian Americans, but other people, including African Americans, Latinx communities, people are coming together saying that the prejudice, hate, fear, and I should also say the Euro-American white communities are coming together. This is not who we are as America. What that means is that we have to redefine what we mean by being an American. A good friend and a colleague and a well-respected scholar, Vartan Gregorian, once said that Every time an immigrant comes to America, he or she learns to be American, and in the process changes what it means to be American. And I think it's that idea of the expansive notion of America that we desire, that we hope for, that we actually aspire to, which is e pluribus unum, right? You know, unity in diversity. We say that, but what does that really mean? That means diversity is the very essence of America. We often say that, but we don't practice it. And so what we have to do is, as communities, we have to come together. I mean, sometimes I will say that in the Asian American community, there was this feeling of, well, Indians don't have much in common with the Chinese, and Chinese don't have much in common with Sri Lankans. So how can we all come together? And I always used to say, our cultural heritage may be different. It is our American presence and American experience and being perceived by others, other Americans, as the other that brings us together. And I think that, as a number of writers have pointed out recently, that if fear is what brings us together, so be it. It's time for us to build coalitions with people all across America, with all kinds of people, as we did with George Floyd's murder, that it's time for us to come together to say, this is not the America that we want to believe in. We do want to aspire to the better union, which is what actually our forefathers had tried to say.
Are there differences in ideas about how to best fight against anti-Asian racism depending on generation? Do the 20-somethings want to do this differently than the 50-somethings?
I would say that the 50-something in that particular age group, which I'm part of, you have majority of Asian Americans who are immigrants, right? So there is a tendency sometimes as a cultural attitude that don't create a fuss, don't speak too loudly, don't actually fight hard. The younger generation is not going to do that, and they're not. Younger generation is out front. In that sense, they're much more American, right? That they're going to fight for what they think is right. Because I do think that Asian Americans have a complexity, which I call the trifecta of complexity. One is that they are seen as the other, the foreigner. The other one is that they're also seen as model minority. And the third one for the older generation is this cultural attitude that don't create a fuss, don't raise your voice, don't complain, and it'll somehow go away. So I get lots of blogs these days, and one of them was from the older group of people who are business leaders who say, silent sojourners no more. And that idea of the silent minority is something that many Asian Americans are now saying, enough already. We got to fight. And the younger generation is already there. I think it's the older generation that has to come together with that.
Talk a little bit about how the exoticization of Asian Americans and sexism combined to sort of magnify the impact for Asian American women in particular of racism.
You know, it's been very interesting to watch this because there are scholars who have talked about this and this notion of bamboo ceiling, for example, for Asian American women in leadership position or in the business, where there is a double whammy. One is to be seen as Asian and exotic, and to be a woman. And then if you go back to the Hollywood films in the 40s and 50s, exoticization of sort of China doll kind of a syndrome, that people who look exotic and therefore they're quite sexualized, whether it goes to Madame Butterfly even. And so those ideas permeate, and I'm told by my scholar friends that it also permeates within the kind of pornographic sites of the exoticism of Asian women. So there is something around there that actually is quite common in this country. And that, as a result, there is some sort of not even a question If you go to get a massage and if they happen to be Asian women, well, they must be sex workers, even if they were not. And so there is that kind of a prejudice, which is a different kind of prejudice from what you might find in other cases of minorities. So we have to really pay attention to the subtlety and nuances of these issues.
You wrote an essay recently about your time at the Asia Society, which initially when you arrived to be, a director at the museum there, there were no other Asian Americans in senior positions on staff?
They were, well, you know, this is what, it gets to be complicated, right? Where Asia Society was founded in 1956. With very good intention by John D. Rockefeller III, and he was deeply, deeply influenced by Asia, went to Asia every year. So he was not a stranger to Asian cultures. And after World War II and Korean War, he felt that Americans didn't know enough about Asia. So hence, he finds the Asia Society that establishes it. And at that point, the focus was so much on Asia over there, because that's what people didn't know. That, and the Asian Americans as a presence in America were not really seen very much. I mean, people forget that, you know, exclusion acts against Asian immigrants were pretty active in America in the mid-20th century. So as a result, there was not much focus on Americans of Asian origin or on Asian Americans in general. Even the phrase Asian American, as you know, doesn't come to be until the late 60s. And by the way, as a direct result of the civil rights movement. And therefore, it's a real kind of sense of partnership that Asian Americans in California had with the civil rights struggle, and it comes out of the civil rights movement, meaning it's about the Americanness of the Asian Americans that Asian American as a terminology comes to be. And I think what happened was that then there was very little focus in the 56 when Asian Society was founded on people of Asian descent. And it went on like that until 1986, when the former president of the Asia Society, Robert R. Oxnam, actually was asked to write a piece about Asian Americans. And that's when people began to say, oh, you mean Asia Society is going to focus on us? And in 1990, when I joined the Asia Society, there were very, very few Asian Americans and only one other person of Japanese descent who was in a position. And we went about, and to be fair to the institution, all of us went about with a full commitment that it was not going to be like that, that we were not going to talk about Asia as if it is separated from Asian America. And we did the first major exhibition, a major, major program of Asian Americans, and the staffing change as well. I think what it does bring up, though, Chris, is that there is something about multiplicity that we want to put in binaries, meaning either you're Asian or you're American. So when I was trying to do the Asian American exhibition, which actually went to Texas as well, I have to say, and so many people said to me, but why are you doing this show? Let the Whitney do it. It's all about America. It has nothing to do with Asia. And I kept saying that Asianness is found in many different ways. Even if Asia, the geography, is far away, not the way we think about Asianness in America. And this was all about actually the exploration of this bicultural identity. And out of that, what I realized is that the strength of America is in this notion of and. It is not that I'm, today, I think of myself as much an American as Indian to some extent. But I carry the American passport and I care about the American politics and I participated in fully, but it doesn't mean that you don't think about the world in a different way. And I keep saying that I think the 21st century really has to be about this notion of multiplicity of belongings. as I talk about it in The World as Family.
How did you go about trying to make the museum more welcoming to Asian American patrons who I guess had perceived it, that it was a place for like white collectors of Asian art before that time?
Well, that's why it was very important that we did an Asian American show. And as I write about in that essay, that, you know, to have an older Chinese American engineer coming to see the show who had never been there before, and to say, I didn't know you cared about my experience, because art has an amazing way to give voice to those who don't feel their voices are heard. It also creates a sense of imagination. And this is true in the visual arts, performing arts, or what you name it. So whose stories you tell matters, right? That's not to say that that's the only way to do it. Art also has a capacity to connect to people across cultures, across boundaries. At least I believe that that's also a very important part of how we perceive art. So the museums exist both about stories told, but also stories that need to be told. And we need to create images that allow people to go beyond themselves, but also see themselves in that art. And that was one of the things that I felt was important. Part of it was also to break out of what some Asian American friends of mine said, that I thought you were only about dead art, old Buddhas and little pots, you know? And so we started doing contemporary art. This is now Asian contemporary art is everywhere, but I'm very proud to say that we were among the first to really take it seriously. And that was already 30 years ago.
What is the significance to you of having a vice president of the United States who is the daughter of immigrants from Jamaica and from India?
You know, I wrote a piece about that too, because I actually felt that to have Kamala Harris actually be appointed as a vice president right after the events of January 6th, the horrific events, it was like a silver lining to me. That is to say to the world, please don't think of America as only what happened on January 6th. What also happened later in January was that a woman of immigrants from Jamaica and India actually came to embody what it meant to be truly American and a beacon to the world that you can actually be brown, black, Jamaican, Indian, and American. So that multiplicity of belonging that is inherent in Kamala Harris's biography really says that the 21st century should be about that notion of capaciousness, expansiveness of belonging. If each one of us is of a particular ethnicity, particular culture, let's not forget that 99.9% of our DNA is the same all over the world. And we have to recognize the climate crisis, the COVID crisis, all these crises suggest that we better actually embrace the humanity that with all our differences, we have to share, and we do share. So Kamala Harris, who, and I had the occasion of meeting her, I loved the way she talked about her aunties wearing saris going to Hindu temples in South India, and at the same time, her mother, who was so very deeply involved in the civil rights struggle, and that therefore what made her American was the multiplicity of her background. And that to me is a very special thing about America.
We hear so often, particularly from women of color, that they have to work harder than everyone else to get where they are. Do you imagine Vice President Harris will continue to have to work harder than vice presidents who have preceded her just based solely on who she is?
I have no doubt. I know from personal experience that you have to work harder only because A, expectations are unreal. B, to get where you are, for people to see that you can do it, you have to work extra hard anyway. And I should also say, and then in fact, Vice President Harris has said before she was running as a running mate to President Biden, and she said that, you know, when she was running as a presidential candidate, she had the largest numbers of trolls and hatred mail of any presidential candidates in the Democratic Party, any. What that says is the negativity is also high. So you have to surmount and you have to go beyond the negativity as well as the sense that somehow show it to me. It's not enough.
What have you learned about rising above that negativity?
One thing I learned from my parents, both of them are gone now, big freedom fighters in India. And my father especially, who always, always, always said that ultimately what you have is your integrity and your belief in yourself, and you have to stay true to that. And I was very fortunate because I grew up in India for the first 16 years of my life, right after India became independent. And the spirit of kind of that notion of new country, new idea that also promoted this notion of unity and diversity. And the title of my book, World as Family, comes from an ancient Indian text that is about how do you treat the world as your family. Those ideals were very paramount and very open and evident in our growing up. And so I find myself to be very blessed to have that solid kind of sense of belonging on which I could continue to build. And that's what I have done. And I think that to some extent, you have to tune out the noise a little bit, you know, to be able to, but it's hard. It's not easy. And you have to remind yourself that you are more than what people think you are.
What makes that sacrifice worth it? To go from a place where at least you won't be subjected to racism, to a country like the United States where there's opportunity, but where you're going to spend the rest of your life dealing at least occasionally, if not regularly, with people who refuse to accept you.
I would say to you, Chris, that actually the beauty of America, and I suspect to some extent Canada, although I don't know, is that in its essence, there is the idea that this country is always becoming. It is in the process of changing and becoming a better nation. That evolution is about its basic tenet that it's in fact not counting the Native Americans, I must say, but that essentially it's an immigrant nation and each immigrant comes and changes this country as well as changing himself or herself. I think that idea is very unique and it's worth it. It's worth it to preserve and worth it to cherish and fight for. And I personally feel that those kinds of things are not possible everywhere. And even in India, yes, I come from a fairly well-to-do family, if you will, but there are conventions, there are limitations, there are actually constraints in terms of the social expectations that are also something you have to fight for. So in a way, I would tell you that you have to fight for something somewhere anyway. In this country, you're fighting for something that actually is at its root, something worth fighting for. And that is this notion of diversity and not so hidebound that you can't actually break it. Now, mind you know, it's not perfect, but as President Obama has often said, that's why we have to strive for that more perfect union. And we are, in fact, a kind of a country that's always in the process of becoming. And I like that.
For non-Asian Americans who want to act as allies, how can we know the difference between the times when it's appropriate for us to raise our voices and the times when it's appropriate for us to just shut up and listen more?
I would say that the very idea that we were just talking about, the ideal of America that is about making a more perfect union and that people can come from everywhere and anywhere. George Washington said that, you know, please come because this is a place if you are persecuted somewhere, if you're hurt somewhere, you can come here. You have place, we have place for you. That ideal we have to fight for. And that is for everybody. In other words, I think in the civil rights space, in the criminal justice space, in voting rights space, these are places that we all have to come together. And that means that Asian Americans, who have not always been very, very visible in fighting for those social justice issues, that's where we have to come together. And we have to speak up for each other. It doesn't matter what race we're in, because if you believe that, then you're going to fight for it. Now, at the same time, when other people can or cannot say, I think sometimes, even if you mean well, if it comes out sounding a little bit condescending or not right, just ask yourself, you know, whether it's right or not. And that's true for everybody. We all have to do that, whether it is about what happened with Breonna Taylor or whether it happened with George Floyd. We have to say, when it comes to justice, we have to fight. When it comes to opinions, just ask yourself how you're going to say it and be reflective. And that goes for everybody.
Vishakha N. Desai is Senior Advisor for Global Affairs to the President of Columbia University. She is Chair of the University's Committee on Global Thought, and she's author of the forthcoming book titled World as Family, A Journey of Multi-Rooted Beginnings. Vishakha, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks very much for making time for us.
My great pleasure, and thank you for having me, Chris.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.